our third case, United States v. Taylor. Ms. Sobel.
May it please the Court. Jeffrey Taylor was convicted by a partial jury after the trial court improperly banned all cross-examination on the heart of his defense. Even if Mr. Taylor's conviction stands, however, he should not be required to register under the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. This Court should adopt a categorical approach to interpreting that act, and as such should find that a conviction for 18 U.S.C. Section 1470 is not, by its nature, a sex offense against a minor. The Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act has a structure that is identical in all pertinent respects to the Armed Career Criminal Act, Section 924, subsection E. The Supreme Court
It doesn't have the elements language in it.
Your Honor, respectfully, it does have the elements language throughout.
Not the section that's implicated here.
That is true, not the section that's implicated here.
Right.
But so, too, does the section, the residual clause of 924E, doesn't reference the elements language either. Both acts first direct the court to look at a conviction and go on to modify that conviction using less precise language. So, for example, Section 924 asks whether or not a defendant has three prior convictions, and then goes on to ask the court to examine whether or not, for example, those convictions involve conduct that presents a serious potential risk. Similarly, SORNA first asks whether or not a person has been convicted of a sex offense, and then goes on to define a sex offense as a conviction for a sex offense as someone who's been convicted of an offense involving a series of categories or conduct.
Right. I mean, it's famously circular.
Your Honor, it may be circular, but it is structurally analogous and, in fact, identical to 924. The process.
Well, but the purposes of the statute are different. 924 adds time to a sentence. This just requires registration. Whereas, you know, the rule of lenity might step in with the ACCA and require some limiting principles by us, the regulatory purpose here is much broader. And so maybe the approach to this difficult statutory interpretation question ought to be different. And this whole debate between a categorical and not categorical approach isn't very helpful.
Your Honor, I understand the difference between the two purposes of the statute. I would note that once a person is required to register as a sex offender,
there are future punishments for failure to register and movement interstate without complying with the terms. I get that. But the registration requirement itself is what we're dealing with here, and whether your client is in or out.
That's true, Your Honor. Once a person is required to register, however, the court will have to undergo the exact same analysis, whether or not under the terms of the statute the person was required to register as a sex offender, and more specifically, whether or not that person had been convicted of, in this case, conduct that by its nature is a sex offense against a minor. And so at the end of the day, whether or not at the initial registration period or later on when being prosecuted for violating those registration requirements, the court's analysis will necessarily be the same. The
Justice Department says that this is an offense against a minor, a sex offense against a minor.
Your Honor, actually, in the regulations that the Justice Department enacted at 73 FR 128, the Justice Department actually advanced adopting a categorical approach to interpreting this.
No. But if we're looking at the same thing, it says conduct by its nature is sex offense against a minor. This is intended to ensure coverage of convictions under statutes defining sexual offenses in which the status of the victim as a minor is an element of an offense. Well, it is an element of 1470, right?
It absolutely is an element. However, I'd focus the court's attention on to the section sexual offense.
Yeah, but I just read you. Conduct by its nature a sex offense against a minor. The Justice Department says that's any sex offense where this the victim's being a minor is an element. So why doesn't that cover this case?
Your Honor, it covers this case insofar as the victim is an the minor is an element of the offense, but it doesn't cover this case insofar as this is not a sex offense. So what the Attorney
this
General...
This is not what?
This is not a sexual offense. The Attorney General's regulations confirm that what Congress intended or what they interpret the statute to mean is that these courts should be looking at the
this
element of the offense.
This is not a sex offense? What would you call it?
Your Honor, it's an obscenity offense. It is not a sexual offense. It's been codified by Congress under Chapter 71. I think we have to assume that Congress intended convictions and criminal offenses to reflect...
Well, obscenity offenses are not categorically out of the grouping of sex offenses by virtue of being obscenity. This is an interstate variable obscenity statute. And there are other obscenity and pornography offenses in the laundry list, which suggests to me that this qualifies.
Your Honor, in fact, I would argue that the fact that Congress specifically included other offenses that could be categorized...
What's the difference between an obscenity offense and giving obscene material to a child? I don't understand that.
I'm not quite sure what statute the court is referencing, but if, for example, the court looks at...
I'm looking at the transfer of obscene material to minor statute, 1470.
Your Honor, that is
an
obscenity.
It's like a sex offense to me.
Your Honor, it was specifically included in the obscenity chapter. Chapter 109...
What difference does that make? I don't understand that.
Your Honor...
So they have some sex offenses involving minors and obscenity. I mean, clearly you can look at the obscenity, you can look at the minor, or you can put them together as 1470 does. So I would say this is an obscenity offense and also a child sex offense.
Well, I direct the court's attention to 18 U.S.C. 2252 B and C to clarify that when Congress intended that an offense involving obscenity and children was to be considered a sex offense, they certainly had the power to categorize it as such. So in those statutes, Congress criminalized the misleading use of domain names or picture or other information to lure children into viewing sexual material. That kind of conduct Congress determined was, in fact, a sex offense. And it still categorized those convictions under a separate chapter of the code, reflecting its belief and its desire that courts treat those kinds of acts as sexual offenses. This conduct, transferring obscene material
to... Why did they mention as being a minor, then, if they want to punish obscenity?
Your Honor, I think it was to give a different kind of category of conviction, to give a different penalty.
Why do they want to punish transferring, selling, so on, obscene materials only to children?
Your Honor, I think it reflects a belief by Congress that transferring obscene materials is a harm, and we take no quarrel with that. We're not saying that it shouldn't be criminal conduct. The question is, however, whether or not it is, by its nature, a sexual offense against a minor.
Well, it's a sexual harm. It's just a different quality of sexual harm.
Your Honor, Congress has determined that it is a harm. We don't disagree with
right.
that. Whether
it's,
or not it's a...
It's corrupting the sexual morals of children by transferring obscene materials to them. I mean, that's the wrong that's being punished here.
Yes. That doesn't make it a sexual offense against a minor.
Oh, come on. Do you have any... This is angels dancing on the head of a pin. Do you have any more concrete claim you want to make?
Well, Your Honor, I'd just like the court to consider the example of an 18-year-old emailing a dirty picture to his 14-year-old brother. Certainly, by its nature, that is not a sex offense against his little brother. That is a violation of 18 U.S.C. 1470. But it is not the kind of offense that we would... imagine Congress anticipated when it enacted SORNA. And Returning to Judge Sykes' question about the differences in interpretation of criminal statutory schemes and non-criminal statutory schemes, I'd just reference the Court to the Supreme Court's opinion in Nichoan, in which the Court interpreted an immigration statute and adopted an approach that we'd advocate the Court.
But suppose this is a typical type of offense we deal with. So suppose someone establishes a web connection, online connection with a minor, and sends the minor obscene pictures of himself. Isn't that a sex offense?
Your Honor, we'd argue that it's not a sex offense for just the reasons I've articulated. This is not a situation in which we have a minor who is not seeking the explicit material. The Supreme Court and courts across the country have been very concerned with the unwilling receipt of obscene materials, as reflected in Miller versus California and other cases. This is not a case where the child, in this case, it wasn't even a child. It was an agent pretending to be a child. It's not the situation where that child is unwittingly flooded with obscene materials. And so the Court can think about it sort of analogously as to a child seeking out obscene materials. Now, certainly there is a harm there, but to say that this is a sexual offense against that minor such that registration is required seems misplaced. In the immigration context in Nijuan,
generally speaking, in sex offenses involving children, we don't take the volitional acts of the child into account. So the fact that the child seeks it or doesn't seek it, or whether it's unwitting or unwanted or otherwise, doesn't really make a difference here.
I understand that.
We presume inability to consent.
I understand that. And legal consent is certainly not a defense, and it is not something that the statute reflects. However,
right, but for purposes of deciding whether this is a sex offense against a child, we don't consider whether the child welcomed it or not.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But what the statute does do is set forth two different kinds of conduct which qualify as sex offenses for the purpose of the statute. One category of conduct requires the sexual activity to be undertaken by the minor, it's him or herself. So that included in that category would be sexual performance, prostitution, child pornography, because all of those kinds of acts require sexual activity by the minor. The other group of offenses that the statute explicitly anticipates being categorized as a sex offense involve conduct that is taken against the will of the minor. So, for example, kidnapping, false imprisonment, and very interestingly, video voyeurism. So that conduct doesn't require that the child engage in any explicit act, but it is an act that is against the will of the minor. And so, although certainly we're not advocating that the court look at legal consent as a defense, Congress seems to have anticipated two very broad categories of conduct that does constitute a sexual offense against a minor, those involving sexual conduct by the minor and those involving sexual acts that are engaged in against the minor's will. Because this conviction does not involve either of those two categories of activity, this cannot be considered a conviction that is, by its nature, a sex offense against a minor. In Nijuan versus Holder, the Supreme Court analyzed an immigration statute that was structured very similarly to the one here. The court was asked to look at whether or not a person had incurred a conviction and whether that conviction involved a monetary amount. In that limited context, the court held that a modified categorical approach would be appropriate just for that single issue of quantity, not whether or not that conviction involved deceit, not whether or not that conviction involved fraud, but whether or not it involved a very limited quantity of money.
That's why do you think that Congress passed 1470?
Your Honor, I think 1470 reflects a congressional belief that exposing minors to obscene material is a harm. There's no disagreement with that.
Well, that makes it sound as if they regarded that as a sexual offense.
Well, Your Honor, there's a plethora of activities that Congress and other legislative bodies have criminalized that reflect a desire to protect children. Those activities don't always make those activities aren't always sexual offenses. And it's not, the Congress didn't require sex offenders.
Sex offense is some sex-related activity regarded as harmful to someone, and if it's a child sex offense, harmful to children. Well, that's the only rationale for 1470.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree that a sex offense is sexually related activity.
Well, I don't understand. If you distribute obscene material to children, why isn't that a sex? It's sexually related. And it's offensive, involves children.
Your Honor, lots of conduct could be sexually related.
I don't understand that. Give me an example.
Of conduct that would be...
You haven't given me any example. I mean, you had your example of the 18-year-old gives it to his little brother or something like that.
Well, Your Honor, I think that is a very good example of the kind of activity that would be covered by 18... USC 1470, but...
Well, they weren't thinking. This is a statute with a 10-year maximum sentence. They weren't thinking of that case. Anyway, your time has expired. You didn't discuss any of your other issues, but we'll take them up with your opponent.
Thank you.
Mr. Benson?
Good morning, and may it please the Court.
The issues that bother me have nothing to do with what your opponent said, but they're in her brief. So first of all, I should have asked her this, but I don't understand. There is, he did raise an issue which is at least colorable, and that is that he thought that, I mean, it's all complicated since, in fact, he was dealing with an adult. But he thought that this person was pretending to be a child. It's actually right. He's pretending to be a child. He bases this partly on the age 18 requirement in Yahoo and partly on, I guess, a belief that there's a lot of this play acting, which I think is true. For example, you know, Second Life? You know, Second Life is...
I'm familiar with it, Your Honor, yes.
In Second Life, 80% of the subscribers to Second Life are male. But only 50% of the avatars are male. So a number of the men are going into this as women. Very strange stuff, okay? But... Isn't it possible that most of the people in these chat rooms who pretend to be teenage girls are men?
As the court is, because the court's already mentioned Second Life, that is a substantially different chat room than the one that was at issue here.
Oh, I know that. But you have, it's pretty strange, I think, in Second Life, that you have men, you know, buying fancy women's dresses and
bizarre.
Pretending to be girls and interacting with the male avatar. Really strange stuff. Well, the next level of strangeness is these chat rooms, pretending to be a teenage girl and talking about sex and so on. Now, maybe most of these, the vast majority of these people are pedophiles, pederasts, what have you, sex offenders. But did he have an opportunity to try to show that?
Yes, Sharon, I believe he did. First of all, I think there is the chat room at issue here. It was a Indiana romance chat room. That was the testimony from the agent. There was no testimony even attempted to be solicited that this was in a Second Life chat room. As the court knows, that's totally different. That is a 100% fantasy chat room where you can be anyone you want. You can be Saddam Hussein. You can be Hitler. You can engage in bestiality. Anything you want. And it's clear that goes on and that's present with everyone. The government's position on why these objections were valid, to a large... First of all, we believe that it's an abuse of discretion standard on this limit on cross-examination. But what really was going on, if you look at the questions closely, first of all, I'd like to talk about what did come out. It came out that you had to engage in this form online that said you had to be 18 years old. And that was asked of the agent. I believe the document was actually even put in evidence. And there was talk about that there's really no one checking. And not only does that testimony in the record, but I think common sense tells every juror that the chat rooms are fair game. There's no way to really monitor what goes on in there, or to verify,
I should say. Right.
So, but look at the questions that were asked. The government does believe that what was going on in the chat room when the defendant and our undercover officer was in there would have relevance to Mr. Taylor's state of mind. No different than, Your Honor, if you and I walked into a bar together, okay, and we're sitting there talking, and we're there together in the bar, and then something happens, and the questions are about what was going on in the bar when you were there. That would certainly be relevant to set the scene and to explain what was occurring. But in this case, let's say that you and I go to the bar on different days or at different times, and what's representative of at noon in the bar when I'm there, and you want to, and your counsel wants to ask me about that, but you're only there at night. That has no relevance what goes on in the bar during the day compared to what goes on at 10 o'clock at night. So in this scenario, if you look at the questions that were asked, the questions were not what was going on in the chat room when you were in there talking to Mr. Taylor. It was what was going on in the chat room. Well, when? If it's going on the day before or the day after, it's not relevant. I think the other thing I would ask the court to be mindful of is that the agent is in the chat room with Mr. Taylor for a minuscule amount of time. All of the chats in the record go on in a private session. That's not for everyone else to see. You know, you can talk in line, you can talk in the chat room, but when you and I really want to talk about something private, we jump out of that chat room where nobody can see what's going on. So there is no evidence as to when Mr. Taylor was in the chat room, what was going on when he was in there, and whether or not what the agent saw at other times, because this was an undercover operation, they were in there for 2 weeks, would that ever have been exposed to Mr. Taylor? So I agree with the court's position that what was going on in the chat room when Mr. Taylor was in there with this agent is relevant, and the government would not have an objection to that question or to that line of question. But a blanket question, was this a chat room where kids were in? Well, when? Also, look at how that agent has to respond to that question. How does he know what people are saying is true and accurate? There is no way to verify that. So the fact that someone even says they're overage.
So they didn't make, the defendant didn't make any effort to call someone who works for Yahoo and who might have some sense of how this, how many phonies there are.
Certainly they could have done that. They had, Mr. Taylor's computer was forensically examined. They had a copy of that report. They could have put in evidence of all the times that his internet history and the time showed when he was in that particular chat room. So I don't know whether that information was in the computer or not, Your Honor. I'm assuming it was because we were able to find out when he was in the chat room. So there were other avenues. So I don't necessarily object to the subject matter of what they wanted to get into. The government's position is that the way they were doing it, the questions they were asking were way too totally overbroad and therefore not relevant because what went on in that chat room when Mr. Taylor wasn't there simply wasn't relevant.
Was the idea to elicit some opinion testimony from the agent about his knowledge of the practices on this chat room and whether it was mostly adults posing as children?
Well, that may have been the attempt, but unless there's something in the record that Mr. Taylor spent more time in the chat room than when he initially met this undercover officer, because all the other conversations are in private. All the chats that's before the court in this trial occurred outside of that chat room. So the fact that the agent may have been able to offer an opinion, are there other kids in the chat room or other adults, unless we know what time or how much time or when Mr. Taylor spent that time in there, it wasn't relevant. A more pointed question would have been, and I agree with that.
So you're suggesting really what he should have said or should have been asked something like that is, well, has he spent other time in this chat room?
He being the agent or Mr. Taylor? I don't know who you're referring to.
Taylor.
Okay.
Yeah. Have you spent other time in this chat room? And the other time, did you learn anything from the conversations that made you suspect that these girls you were talking to were actually adults or men?
If it would have been in the same, well, are you saying that they?
Well, was
they,
he asked anything like that?
Who, the agent?
No, Taylor.
No, he didn't.
Was he asked? You know, what makes you think that these that what makes you think that the people you talk to there are really men?
I don't believe he testified.
Or that the agent? Did he testify that he thought she was a man?
No, he never took the stand. No.
Oh, he didn't testify.
No, Your Honor. No, he did not.
Okay. No. So let me ask you about the jury. Issues. I don't understand why the judge didn't eliminate these jurors for cause. I mean, you have plenty of jurors, right? The veneer is large enough. You know,
I assume it was. I don't think that was an issue here.
Right.
At all.
Right. So the woman who a child had been raped.
Yeah, that would be juror CP.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be? Wouldn't you want us not have a juror like that?
I would start with, well, I believe that ultimately her answers comported her to the stand to be able to sit on the juror. But regardless, the wrongful denial of the cause challenge when that juror is ultimately struck isn't relevant. It's whether or not the final jury that sat was neutral and not
biased.
Well,
I'm a little puzzled by that because if a juror is not struck for cause, then you have to use a peremptory challenge, and then you run out of your peremptory challenges, and that could be prejudicial, right? You end up with no peremptory challenges because the judge doesn't ever strike a juror for cause. As long as the juror says, yes, I can be impartial.
My answer is twofold. One, in Ross versus Oklahoma, you know, the Supreme Court said that the loss of a peremptory challenge, that doesn't constitute a violation of a constitutional right to an impartial jury. So long as the jury that sits is impartial, the fact that the defendant had to use a peremptory challenge to achieve that result does not mean the Sixth Amendment was violated. So I'm just going along with mm-hmm. the Supreme Court said. But to get back to the more fundamental point, Your Honor, is should this juror have been struck for cause? I think trial courts are in difficult positions. Jurors come to the court at 7 in the morning, and having done this over 100 jury trials, they want to do the right thing. I really believe in our jury system, and they want to be there
and
do the right thing.
I agree with you. I mean, I'm not an experienced trial judge, but I do trials from time to time in the district court. I've been impressed. The federal jurors here, also in Hammond, I think they're conscientious. But on the other hand, you can be conscientious and you can be not fully conscious of your own, psychology.
Conscientious to a fault. But here's what the trial courts have to go through. They have to take what these potential jurors are saying, and they divulge sometimes very personal stuff at the bench, things that they have never divulged to anyone else, especially in these kind of cases. And that's what makes me believe in our jury system, because of what you find out during voir dire in the privacy of a bench conference. But then the court has to take what they say about them being so honest to disclose something that so much hurts them. But then in the same note, they say, after more questioning, I know this has hurt me, and I told you about this, and I didn't want to, and I'm telling you I still can sit on this jury because I can put that out of my mind, because it isn't this defendant that did it. He's not responsible, and this is a different crime. So the district courts are in a difficult position to ask jurors to be so honest with them, to reveal things that are important for both the defense counsel and the government to know so we can make an informed decision, but then say, well, I don't believe you when you tell me that you can put that out of your mind. That is a difficult balancing act. And the court can observe the jurors. How do they volunteer the information? What is their demeanor? What is the inflection of their voice when they say, I know this is, I know this happened to me, but I can be fair and impartial to this defendant because he didn't do this to me or my child. And I think that in this case, you have a juror who disclosed that, a terrible thing that happened to her family, but in the same line of questioning was so honest in that she said that, but then said, yes, that doesn't have anything to do with this case, Your Honor. I can sit here and I can put this out of my mind, and it's not against him. That's difficult, but I think we have to take the jurors at their word, especially when they disclose something that is so intimate and so difficult. Mm-hmm. I think that builds their credibility with the court when they disclose those kind of things. You know, such as a case where a juror for the first time, and we always ask the question in the alternative, have you or any member of your family, have you or anybody you've known been a victim of a sexual exploitation? Inevitably, hands go up. We ask it in the alternative so as not to embarrass them. And they approach, and they tell us, I've had it happen before, where for the first time in their life, they're telling someone that they were raped or molested. Mm-hmm. They're disclosing that to a federal court in tears. That is an unbelievable taking that oh so seriously to say that. And then to turn around, and when that person says, yes, I know that was horrible, but it was a year ago or 5 years ago, and I can be fair and honest, no, we think you're lying now. We don't think you can be. Not that you're lying, that you don't understand the perception of what happened to you and what you need to do. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult position for a trial court. In this case, first of all, the both of these jurors were unequivocal about what they could do and how they could put that out of their mind. And this case was different. I mean, there was some overlap. I don't deny that in terms of the kinds of issues that these jurors had to deal with. But on the same note, they were very honest, and I think you have to give them some credit for that when they say that.
Since I deflected you onto these issues, you haven't had a chance. Would you like to make a brief response with regard to the double jeopardy issue?
Certainly, Your Honor. We believe that Blockberger controls under Gray. I think defense counsel may have had an argument, but Dixon clearly overruled Gray, and even them themselves, the defense themselves, acknowledge that Dixon and Blockberger control. And if it was a different decade ago, the government would have a different result, but maybe the government never would have went forward with this right. Prosecution.
SORNA? The registration requirement?
Yes. Uh-huh.
The government's position apparently is that a categorical approach applies to the age element of the statute, but nothing else.
We believe that a categorical approach would allow the government to prevail, as well as a non-categorical approach. The intent of the statute, I mean, if you look at Dodge,
what's
and I'm not going
to... What's the Justice Department's position?
Yes. I'm sorry. I couldn't hear you.
That was actually not a yes or no question.
Okay, I thought you said that is the Justice Department. I'm sorry.
That it survives either way. But, I mean, is the Justice Department advocating for a categorical approach or no?
We believe that it can survive under either of them.
So you're agnostic on how the statute ought to be
evaluated. I think it's a little more than agnostic. We're saying that we believe it can. This 18 U.S.C. 1470, that the government wins either way, and the court doesn't necessarily need to reach a conclusion that it doesn't have to.
Okay, so the government hasn't taken a position about how this catch-all in the registration statute ought to be interpreted either categorically or not categorically.
No, we believe that this statute would allow the government to fail on both.
I get that part.
Okay, I'm
okay.
Sorry.
Is it the case that the government has not formulated a position on the proper way to interpret this statute categorically or just based on the conduct in question? You understand the distinction.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely, I do. And I would say no, we have not.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Benson. So, Ms. Sobel, I think your time expired, but you can have another minute if you want. Let me ask you about the question of what actually goes on in these chat rooms. Couldn't you have presented evidence from Yahoo or from, sociologists or someone about the actual character of the average age of the people in these chat rooms, whether they're really children or whether they're adults pretending to be children?
trial counsel could have attempted to introduce evidence that way. However, trial counsel's
ethics... But there isn't any evidence of that sort, is there?
There's not, because every time trial counsel asked either Agent Brown or Investigator Pruitt information...
No, but that's not the right people to ask. There are people who study these issues, and there, of course, is the company. I'm sure would be reluctant to talk about it, but, you know, they can be subpoenaed.
Of course that's right, Your Honor. As the Court knows, the defense has no burden to present evidence. But what trial counsel attempted to do was prove his defense or create reasonable doubt about the age of the people who were actually in the chat rooms themselves by asking Investigator Pruitt and Agent Brown about their observations about the profiles of the people with whom they and Mr. Taylor were in a chat room together with. Every effort that trial counsel made to go down that path to talk about the user population, the norms and practices in that chat room, were immediately shut down on relevance grounds by the prosecutor and by the trial judge. And this goes directly to the heart of Mr. Taylor's defense, which is that he thought he was play-acting. He didn't know how old the person
well,
he was
now,
corresponding
what,
with.
What would be an example of a question asked to one of the agents that he was not required to answer, do you think would be germane?
For example, I turn the Court's attention to page 193 of the second volume of the transcript. Trial counsel was cross-examining Investigator Pruitt about her observations, just her observations about the people who were in the chat rooms. And she asked, and most of the people that you were coming into contact with were not mostly middle schoolers, correct?
Wait, I can't hear you. Can you speak louder and slower?
Sure, I apologize. Trial counsel asked Investigator Pruitt, and the people that you were coming into contact with were not mostly middle schoolers, correct?
We're not, I can't hear you. We're not,
what? We're not mostly middle schoolers.
We're not mostly middle
yeah,
schoolers.
Yeah, so the phrasing is a little bit awkward, but the heart of the question was, let's talk about the age of the people you were seeing, whose profiles you could access, who were in the chat room with you, the very chat room that Mr. Taylor was in. And that goes to the heart of Mr. Taylor's defense, because those are observations he could have made.
How would the agents have known that?
Your Honor,
were they qualified as experts?
There are public profiles. And so there are
you can make those up.
Of course.
I don't understand. What did she mean?
From reading the record, what she meant is when you go into these chat rooms, you encounter a bunch of people, the overwhelming majority, if not all of whom, were representing themselves to be adults. And that later on, as the Court noted in Gladish and referenced when talking to Mr. Benson, later on people go on to play act, to engage in fantasy and to have conversations.
So was this agent testifying that there were a lot of play actors there?
Your Honor, every attempt by counsel to engage on
you said she gave this answer about the middle schoolers. Was that a statement about play acting?
She was not permitted to answer the question.
I don't understand. You just said she said they weren't middle schoolers.
Your Honor, the question was never answered. That's the question that
trial
counsel...
What's the question? The question was about middle schoolers?
Trial counsel asked Investigator Pruitt if most of the people that she encountered were not middle schoolers. So, for example, were adults. That question was objected to. And that question and others like it foreclosed Mr. Taylor's defense, which is that the people he was encountering, the norms and the common practices of the chat room, and excluding the norms and common practices, you know, in the past or in the future, the chat room that he was in, that they were all in together, was composed of people who were adults, consistent with Yahoo's user policy, and that in the context of these chats, people engage in fantasy and in banter. And because of that, he believed that Ellie Girl 1234 was in fact over the age of 18 and certainly over the age of 16.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Sobel. And so you're a defender?
I am.
So we thank the defenders for their defense.
Thank you.
And we thank Mr. Benson.